Welcome. So today is non-archive discussion, and let's keep it in discussion format. I prepared some stuff to discuss. And it's used, and it still can be called archive discussion because we'll discuss one of the papers that was posted to archive, one of the papers of 2017 on the scaling. On the scaling of number of open diffuse galaxies with M to, although now I'm not so sure if it's C or, but I should have left it just M 200, just as an additional paper to maintain the mystery of what it means. The second paper that's also on our archive by Peter van Dokkum that came out months ago, or less than months. We plan to discuss it, but actually Aaron Manowski, who is arriving on Sunday, when he saw the email, said that I'll be here next week, so why don't I keep the closer, so why don't I discuss it? So we'll discuss it next week. For those of you who are leaving, you can watch it online. And of course, it's better if we actually hear from the person who participated in the paper rather than try to reconstruct it. So so before we go to Wunderberg, I saw that it would be nice to orient ourselves about what we're talking about, because my impression definitely is that there's a lot of confusion about the topic, the definitions. That's the most personal experience and impression I get from talking to people. So I wanted to start with a definition of open diffuse galaxies, the way they're defined by the papers that discuss them. But before, I want to talk about why it matters, why we should talk about them, why this is potentially interesting. But I think it's impossible to talk about that without actually defining them, what they are. But I would just say that they're clearly relevant for this workshop because we talk about connection between galaxies and halos. This is a logo of this workshop, right? It represents what we're talking about, the luminous parts of the galaxies and the color distribution that's shown in a grayscale. If you look at one of the recent papers that discusses the BGs, of course, you know, the same color scale. Right? And about the around these bright galaxies, somewhere in the dark matter web that surrounds them, which you don't see here, but we saw in the previous scale, there are tiny things, very fudgy, very close to brightness, and they are ultra-diffuse galaxies. So, in addition to bright galaxies that we usually discuss, there is these things lurking around. And the thing that we've been getting people excited in the last couple of years is that the numbers of these fuzzy diffuse things seem to be huge. The universe is full of them. So that's what makes them potentially interesting. So how do I define? So the definition, there's no single definition. And this is one thing that you should be aware of. If you try to model them, if you try to think about them, if you try to compare them to something, or compare different studies with different definitions. So for example, I read one of the first studies that started recent trend, Sycam about this galaxy, Peter van Dokkum, et al., 2015. They defined it essentially, they looked at the coma cluster, they had a survey with Dragonfly instrument, looking for low surface brightness faint systems. And they identified 47 of what they called outer diffuse galaxies with the following criteria. They have to be the effective radius, the radius including half-life, had to be larger than 1.5 kiloparsec. And the surface, essential surface brightness obtained from feet of eccentric profiles in G band is larger than 24 magnitudes per square second. I guess what you see from but then I need to know what surface brightness is.
Central brain?
R0, so you fit the profile, right, and you separate it to R0. So surface brightness in this case, it's magnitudes per square second, so people define it as in the band, it's a magnitude in the 10 plus 2.5 log 10. The omega, where the omega is sort of angle which you collect the flux to this magnitude. And when this is in magnitude and this is in square seconds, then you get surface brightness in magnitude per square second. So in original, what was interesting is that some of these 47 galaxies had sizes up to 5 kiloparsecs or so. The largest one, I think, was about 4.7 kiloparsec. Dragonfly 44.
So, Andrei, sorry, here there is no cutting mass in any way, right?
No.
So, independently of the mass, the cutting in the scale length is the size.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So with colors, there's something. So often I see cuts in colors, and then I'm not so sure what kind of each study is doing something, and we have to go through all the observational mumbo jumbo to see what they're doing. But there's sometimes they also cut some size in colors, but no cutting in this. So this study was followed up by a study by the Japanese group, for example, by Koda et al. This group also had follow-up studies where they confirmed some of the galaxies spectroscopically. They showed that they're in coma, but also they're clustering. So the reason you know it's they're in coma, they're kind of concentrated over the center of the cluster, so they're correlated. Koda et al. And the catalog actually was published in Yagi. So here they defined it. They identified 850 Koda et al. PGTs in coma. Yeah. But here there was a cut in magnitude, so they looked at objects brighter than 12th magnitude in R. The surface brightness cut was somewhat different because they cut not on the central surface brightness, but on average surface brightness in with an effective radius. And 24.3, 27.3, and effective radius cut was actually 0.8 kiloparsecs, so twice lower than the same. So okay, so you know you can see this is just to show that the definitions are not the same. So when numbers are quoted, for example, right, we're dealing with some different class, and so that therefore when you compare them, you have to take this into account. And then, just as an example, Wanderberg, the paper that we're discussing today, there's Wanderberg et al. 2016, and then this 2017 paper that came out this month. They defined it, again, differently, MR less than minus 16.8, effective radius larger than 1.5 kiloparsec. Surface brightness is defined as mean surface brightness and effective radius is limits. And we also do some cuts on when they keep searching points and also searching quotient 4. And in Wanderberg 2017, when they cross-correlated with groups and clusters, they also, it's kind of interesting because they deal with PGGs in the field, and so they don't know the redshifts, and so they select on sizes in seconds. Then when they cross-correlate them with each group, they assume that the PGGs are the redshifts of the group. But groups with different redshifts don't satisfy their cuts, and so there is, it's not very clear exactly what sizes they include for each system. They're somewhere in the ballpark of these sizes, but they're not exactly satisfying. It's sort of statistical. Anyway, so...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, another basic question. I don't know. So if you have a galaxy with similar surface density, but much more compact, what is that called? Is that just a normal dwarf galaxy with such surface density? I just don't recall the numbers.
let's see, so signal surface brightness.
Right, so surface brightness. It will be a Bosroid.
Yes, except it's Bosroid also. There are dwarf ellipticals in those. Actually, it works right. So how much more compact? Fine.
I mean, just below. The
so they define the threshold. Just a bit more compact would be called dwarf ellipticals.
Okay. This low level one is would be so low you wouldn't see it except in the level group, and you usually resolve the stars that are dwarf ellipticals.
Right. So that's right. And I can continue. Do you want me to continue?
But in the sensor index theory in the third paper, is it useful? The sensor index cut.
Yeah. I think it's probably preventing some bad fits. So one interesting feature of these galaxies, once they're defined this way, is that their surging indices are peaking with about 1, actually about 0.8. So they're roughly exponential. But they're not disks. And we know that they're not disks because their V over A distribution does not look like distribution for inclined disks. It never goes to very small values, so it means that you never see them fit drawn being thin. They look like a trilite cell, maybe prolate systems. Maybe oblate or prolate, actually, I don't know if it's not. At best, they have thick disks, very thick disks.
Yeah, so that is the same as for most variables. They're also good fits to exponentials
and dwarf ellipticals.
And most dwarf ellipticals, that's right. And probably not this.
Right. So I'm not going to write it down. This is just to impress on you that when people talk about outer diffuse galaxies, the definitions in each paper vary. There's no single universal definition. And I should say that also people now are looking for these things in the field, or at least in the outskirts, outside the clusters. And there, again, you start reading the definitions somewhat different. For example, a recent paper by Raman and Trujillo, 2017, they looked at Sloan Stripe 82 around ABO 168. And they were interested to see if they can find these galaxies outside the cluster. And they do find them. And there they define the sample as having circularized radii about 1.25, and they actually force them to have blue colors. The galaxies here, they actually are selected. When they're selected, they're mostly red, essentially on the red sequence. Whereas these guys excluded everything that's on the red sequence and found a bunch of EDGs that are blue. Right. So there again, you know, the cuts on size and surface brightness are similar, but they actually select an object of different color.
So is there, so obviously it's an interesting sort of general observational class, but is there, from the theoretical perspective, an appropriate definition that is you know, useful for comparing with these, or that is right. Actually a challenge?
Right, so right? Now why do we care? Why do we have to go through all this observational mumbo jumbo to understand what they're talking about? Why do we care? So the reason people care and got excited about them is that the sizes of the largest of these UDGs are of order 4 or 5 kiloparsecs, as I said, in coma cluster. The luminosities are more than 2 orders of magnitude below L star, and 4 kiloparsec is also half-light radius of Milky Way. Right. So you're seeing something that's 2 orders of magnitude smaller stellar mass or more. But size of the Milky Way. And so the thinking was that maybe these things are some sort of new type of galaxy that really sits in a 10 to the 12 solar mass halo, but is a failed galaxy, which didn't form, formed only a tiny fraction, 1% of the Milky Way mass in terms of stellar mass. If that's the case, clearly we're studying galaxy halo connection. That's something we should care about. If there are halos where stars are 1% of what we think on the average these halos contain, right? When we talk about stellar mass halo mass relation. So implication of these galaxies for the stellar mass halo mass relation and also for size halo radius relation are very interesting if they are indeed such huge outliers, this relation. So in other words, we can use them to probe the scatter in this relation beyond of what we currently understand. The current thinking is that at least the bright galaxies that we know the stellar mass, halo mass relation, and the scatter about that relation is about 0.2 decks. antibody. These things could have maybe indicating, or potentially could have indicated, that the scatter is much larger.
Well, not really, because we have to get a halo mass.
Yeah, you're taking a cat, right? I'm just saying why this potential is interesting. And the first papers did kind of argue that this could be big galaxies sitting in front of these solar mass halos. Now, the big question is, what are they? Clearly, the stellar masses, what's not controversial is that their sizes are large and their stellar masses are small. Therefore, surface brightness is.
There's a purely observational plot. You can see this, get some idea on this. We just plot luminosity against size and take all galaxies in the coma cluster. You can see whether these guys lie off in a separate region or whether they're just appear to be a tail of the rest of the distribution. And I haven't seen that plot.
I haven't seen it today. But in the right place.
Because I've seen surface brightness versus size for them, but I've never seen magnitude versus size and seen them on that.
Luminosity or stellar mass.
Yeah, like in the original from Dokken paper has a plot of surface brightness and size, and then a bunch of slow galaxies on it, and then these UDGs.
That's good enough.
Except that if there is.
Yeah, there were cuts on the other populations of galaxies shown on that plot.
So for example, the Yagi et al., or the Kodo, they have this.
Really good supreme cat image of coma, and you know, they can just plot everything, not just this population.
Another thing that just to finish with motivation, I hope, was it enough?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
In terms of why we care?
Oh, no, I mean, my question wasn't why we care, because I care about everything. I think my question was more, you know, your point of saying that these are different definitions is a cautionary tale. But is there an appropriate, one of the things you might hope to do is if there's like an appropriate way to do some comparison that could, be helpful for, as opposed to, a lot of these are subsets of, these are pretty complementary, the CODA and the Vandenberg. Presumably, the Dendalkum and the CODA papers are disjoint because of the cut on effective radius, or not completely so, but... so that's what makes it really hard to compare. And so you'd like to have actually a definition that one can put all of these observations in the same framework.
Well, I can actually code it. I'll do find all the Van Dokken galaxies. I think
they have to check that. Van Dokken galaxies are a subset, yeah.
The Van Dokken ones are the subset, yeah.
Yeah, very much.
And I should say that observational definitions are driven by observational limitations, right? Or some choices to select particular type of objects for particular reason. Theoretically, we want all galaxies, ideally, right? There's no limitation, there's no surface brightness cuts. But that's much, so far, it's not an achievable goal. There's always money between the surface brightness limits and so on. So theoretically, we would like to see the whole population as it exists and then interpret it, right? So I don't think there is particular theoretical motivation to define what is the ultimate diffuse galaxy is. This is not really a caution there, just to be aware that this is the case, the definitions differ. What you can see similar about this definition is that they all select low surface density brightness galaxies, right, with large sizes. And they tend to find galaxies, when they make those selections, they tend to find galaxies that are small in size. Small in stellar mass and luminosity. Why is that? Well, we know that as we go down in luminosity, this is Sloan galaxies in R-band surface brightness in R50 as a function of absolute magnitude. And as you go to fainter galaxies, the surface brightness goes again, up or down. This one is up.
Spreading more stars over bigger surface area, so it's going down.
I hear the cut at the top is actually observational.
You Sloan peters out in the surface brightness, so you're running out to get the surface brightness unit for the Sloan, and therefore, the UGG galaxy is somewhere over there, by definition, because that's sounds a lower cut. Sloan doesn't touch them because it's too big of a thing. Right, but it's known, for example, here's people know about this overall trend, and when we study low luminosity galaxies, it's known that we can maybe missing a large fraction of the galaxies. This is plot from driver at all, 2004. I'm pretty sure there's maybe follow-up papers. I don't get there's some papers by Loveday and so on, where you see distributional surface brightness in beams of galaxy absolute magnitude, right? So for bright galaxies, it's known that the surface brightness is more or less the same. It's called so-called Freeman's law. But as you go to, down to fainter and fainter galaxies, you see that the peak starts to shift. The galaxies become lower surface brightness. And then for the smallest beams, you see that there is a significant fraction of the population sits in an available region of low surface brightness that surveys that existed at that time could not touch. And again, you see that the typical definition of the PDGs is about 24. I don't know which band it is, but it's somewhere here. So they're essentially in this range, which is close to typical surface brightness limit of the surface.
What is the sort of LSST deep image effective surface brightness limit?
Somebody else has gone to that.
Much deeper.
Much deeper.
Well, I mean, there's no number for it. I thought it was like 29, but I'm not sure.
No. So I think in the full 10-year survey stack, you get to point sources of 28 to 29. But surface brightness is going to be less than that. So
if you don't see it, it's.
But it should be significantly
more. Not necessarily if they're big.
Yeah.
It depends on the star shape.
And you can see all the stars.
And then you can smooth when you get further than it's good there.
Yes, if they do that.
That's how slow and fast.
About 27 magnitudes per arc second in the R band after 10 years.
Thank you.
But I think this is just per pixel, right? I'm not sure what this means exactly in terms of detecting.
Well, I think Dragonfly gets it already.
If Dragonfly goes down.
I'm just reading a thread by Andy Connolly. He says 27 magnitudes per arc second after 10 years. And sorry, I was wrong. It's not I band.
There are places in SLM where they've gone deeper, right? There's Stripe 82. So they can quantify, to some extent, what they're missing. They can see what they're missing.
Well, and these Supreme Cam things go much deeper. So a lot of the lensing surveys go much deeper.
Yeah. So all these additional surveys essentially finding, so auto diffuse galaxies in this range. So they're finding galaxies in this tail. So as you can see, I mean, this is essentially what people thought the distribution looks like. So existence of the tail was kind of expected. People worried when they measure the Nostra function, they worry about this, some people worry about the load because they know that they're missing this low source of brightness galaxy, and they have to correct for this fraction.
Well, in fact, they've known in the local group for years. What those other goes through is, it's surprising here, it's just a bigger than what physically
possible. So one question that people ask, in particular here during previous discussions Frank has asked, is are these guys different from the galaxies we knew for years, since 1980s or maybe earlier, what's the brightness galaxy, so-called? So here's, you can get a sense of that answer to that question from this three plots from the review by Paulson, Eadie, and Margot, back in 1997. So my reading of this is no, there's no difference.
Yeah.
But definition of low surface brightness galaxies was much more lax than definition of ultra diffuse galaxies. Essentially, people have started to discover galaxies which have surface brightness considerably lower than this peak of the distribution, which is so-called Freeman's law. This is Gaussian at high luminosities, and so they were finding galaxies lower and lower surface brightnesses. I think they just called everything that doesn't conform to this law as a low surface brightness galaxy. And as you can see, again, it extends to 24. At that time, the number of galaxies below 24 there was not that many known, but they expected this to be continued. Then you see that this number density just continues. And here's a plot from the same review. This is central surface brightness, and some, I think it's B. This is scalens of the exponential that they fitted. And if you use those type of definitions, right, there is a scale here, that's an ultra diffuse galaxy region. But what they call these points are low surface brightness galaxies. So, in some sense, ultra diffuse galaxies seem to be extreme surface brightness and size and of the low surface brightness galaxies. And funnily enough, this is the luminosity function of galaxies in Virgo. Sorry for the quality, but actually, quality of the original images is not that much greater than scans that you can find in DS. This is the actual diagnostic function for raw counts. Then they make corrections for magnitude limit and for surface brightness. And this is their estimate of what the number of holes in brightness galaxy should be in coma, in Virgo, sorry. And they get something in the hundreds, so which is close to what people are finding now for the diffuse galaxies. And one more thing, this again, this is the later paper by Margaret Geller et al. Claudia, maybe, yes. It's a shell survey. Anyway.
It just depends on
the name. It is just gold.
The H is not Margaret.
So this is one case where people try to measure the luminosity function of galaxies and worried about loss of brightness galaxies. So we went and tried to quantify the loss of brightness population, and they show you contribution of LSBs, loss of brightness galaxies, to the overall luminosity function. So here is a dashed line, here is a high surface brightness galaxy, so standard galaxies, and here is a low surface brightness galaxy. And you can see that the dwarf luminosity is eliminated. Most of the galaxies in the galaxy are low surface brightness. And again, some of these are in the range of surface brightnesses, and the luminosity is the ultra-faint, ultra-diffuse galaxies.
I think the one main sort of difference is that most of these low surface brightnesses, what people call low surface brightness galaxies, really large low surface brightness renewal for things like Malian galaxies, which are very gas-rich, whereas those things in coma appear have very little to no gas, it's a little more quenched. But apparently there was also a paper recently that looked into this and found again a huge variation in UDGs defined according to some criterion.
More than that, there is this alpha-alpha paper. Recently I can find the author. I don't have any quotes from it, but it just came out 2 months ago, same month, where they search for galaxies with kind of these type of definitions in alpha-alpha with the Sloan data. I don't remember where the metric is coming from. But effectively, they found a bunch, and they all have gas, and then blue. Likewise, when people search in Site 82 with Roman and Tokia, searching for low surface brightness blue objects, they found the top of them as well. So they're all over the place. They look like dwarf radios.
Is the gas distribution compact relative to the stellar distribution in these cases?
Usually, yeah, it's a comparable, much larger. Okay. Yeah, so most extreme ones, I think, have
larger. Much larger, even in like the center of coma, like.
Coma is all red. Coma, they have no gas. But again, I don't know how much of this is just because they were selected to be red, or I know that people, at least some, I think, Coda selected against blue galaxies when they selected. Another study on Stripe 52, they actually excluded all red galaxies, and they were selected a bunch of blue images. So I think there is a probably, it looks like there is a range of colors, and then maybe, probably, a gradient, that as you go to clusters, they become red and gets poor. But they exist everywhere, essentially. What's better known now about clusters is their abundance, and that's the subject of the Sloan work paper. But before we get there, let's talk about how they fit in stellar population, right? This is a plot from the Van Dokkum et al. 2015. This is their definition of UDGs, these solid lines that they cut. And this is in a plane of circularized effector radius versus deep-band absolute magnitude. And they compare them to just spheroidal galaxies. And you can see that in this presentation, they look like a separate population of much fainter but much larger galaxies compared to dwarf reticles. Now, why compare them to spheroidals? Because they're not disks. Like I said, they look like they're spheroids. And the coma, they also were red. Huh?
So they essentially look like dwarf spheroidals, just more massive ones, right? So they have similar surface brightness.
They're actually higher surface brightness than dwarf spheroidals.
Because the constant lines of constant surface brightness are like layers, right? Yeah, so they even have somewhat high. So. Right. But this, of course, just comparing to spheroidal galaxies, if you actually compare this, this is from the paper by Raman and Tokia, who looked at the Stripe 82, and here they just plot everything from massless galaxies to what they call 3DGs here. These galaxies have spectra, these ones don't. And I think all of these are more or less blue. And you can see that there is a continuous galaxies.
Can you go back to the previous? Because there's another group of things that we see, C's, compact ellipticals. And when we were writing the book, there was five of them known. And recently I've seen talks where they're all, there's huge groups of those things which always were missed because of star-galaxy separation issue. So most of these areas just filled up and it's all selection effects we're looking at.
Right, but there's also between dwarf ellipticals and here, they're also dwarf regulars.
It's all filled up.
But there are probably also dwarf ellipticals in there in the sense that the surveys that got the grey dots were biased against these kind of objects. And so,
right. So here's a plot I made yesterday where I used some of the data I played with before, and I added the ultra diffuse galaxy. So this is half-life radius function stellar mass. Here is Sloan galaxies, which are split on morphology, blue solid line and red solid line. They're corresponding gamma flux in the gamma survey, which is how different things are, and so these are normal galaxies, and then Sloan peters out essentially 10 to 9 or so, it becomes incomplete, and there you can see there just some representation of some samples. This is things galaxies and little things shown by blue points. Those are all galaxies that have essentially have gas, so they're selected to have H1. Things is an H1 survey for those who don't know. So they're all dwarf, like in this regime, they're all called dwarf irregulars. The red points are dwarf ellipticals. Some of them, I think, are the same from the previous plot. It's from the sample of Misgeld and Kilker. Anyway, sample 2008. It's available online. And these orange points, the ultra-diffuse galaxies. The yellowish points are from Kodai et al., it's the Diag et al. Catalog, and the dark orange is from the catalog from 2015. Now you can see that they're actually serving the same format, which is the same galaxies, but actually they seem to be like offset. I think it's completely due to stellar mass estimation. When I estimate stellar masses for these galaxies, here I try to reproduce what they do in the paper. If I estimate stellar masses the way I do it for these galaxies, which is using Bell et al. 2003, and average color, then these orange points start to line up here. So we shift the factor of 2 to the right. But regardless, I think it's pretty clear from this picture is that these guys are essentially line an extension of dwarf regular dwarf elliptical distribution for dwarf galaxies. The dashed lines here, the solid and blue is what you would get if you just assume that half-life radius is proportional to video radius and then use up 100C derived from abundance matching. So you can see that the bright luminosity is this assumption that reproduces the band that you see in sizes. This is why
this is the median lines, right?
The solid lines are medians, yes. So for way past
the solid line or the dashed line?
Solid lines are medians. Dashed line is just the line. Right? It's just the line I get from assuming average stellar mass, given mass for each one.
So that's the median predicted by the relation.
Yeah. Right. And here it's extrapolation because it's based on a gamma survey which kind of reaches its stellar mass, but it becomes uncertain. So here's just extrapolation of what this would imply for the dwarf galaxies. The shaded region is 0.25 dex, which is expected 1 sigma scatter from spins. So we believe that spins have anything to do with sizes, so just for reference, to give you an idea about how it compares with theoretical expected scatter.
It's only 1 sigma, right?
1 sigma,
68%.
So those aren't even 2 sigma? It's a log plot. So it doesn't look like that little bit of 2 sigma.
So the ultra diffuse galaxy, I would say, look like they lie on extension of the size stellar mass relation for late type disks. The search can use for the unity, so it's not crazy to extend them. They overlap pretty substantially with dwarf irregulars and some of the dwarf ellipticals. And if the largest of them may be beyond 1 signal, but not too far beyond 1 signal. Now, if you look at a theoretical paper by Mariska and Ward that came out last year, they have a second conclusion. The model observed samples and they conclude that they're just a tail. They're high spin tail, not far tail, but just on the high spin side of the
distribution. One sixth of the tail.
Yeah.
So the correlation in the end is what's the mass of the papers.
Okay, yeah. So just looking at observable properties, they essentially look like extension of a dwarf population towards low surface brightness at large sizes. And that's what a lot of papers have been concluding recently. In theoretical, both observational papers, because people make flows like this, and they feel just extension. But we were here 2 weeks ago, we talked to Song Huang, and he made the same statement. They look at Virgo cluster, I think, in their survey, and they see this continuous distribution extending towards low surface brightnesses. Right, so theoretically, the question is, what is their stellar mark? What is their halo mass? Right. And that's what makes it interesting. So if they're living in massive halos, then it immediately become very interesting because they have very low stellar masses. So then in this case, if they live in high mass halos, so say L star, which is here, right, it means that their sizes are normal, but stellar masses are way suppressed. If they live in small mass halos, like 10 to 11, then their sizes are normal, but stellar masses may be too low. Not by a huge factor, but by maybe a smaller factor. So I think the crux of the argument that's ongoing right now in this literature is what is their halo mass. Direct estimates of are impossible, so people have attempted to measure.
If the Milky Way mass, then you can find it by Lanzer.
Right, and that attempt has been made by Sifonto, published this year. They could only put upper limit. The upper limit was 11.8 in log halo mass, so the low 10 to 12. But not very helpful. So it could be as high as 10 to 12 still, maybe close, but can be higher than that. The estimates, there's a couple of galaxies for which velocity dispersions of stars have been measured. And those, of course, are measured with an effective radius, and you can estimate the angular mass in that, inside that radius. Those estimates suggest masses of order 10 to 11.
So it's a huge extrapolation. Yeah, huge extrapolation. So I should point out, I was reading again this afternoon. So Docker measured two velocity dispersions. One was 30 kilometers per second, one was 40 kilometers per second, 32. Instrumental dispersion was 32 kilometers per second.
So I noted that.
So if you measure 32 kilometers per second, you measure 30 kilometers per second. That's consistent with zero.
Well, when I read this, I noted that fact, but then I think, okay, well, these are expert observers, so they must know how to extract sigma out of data with resolution of the sigma.
Yeah, but not with that coherent error, but it's really...
Well, they also have an increasing effect of their papers.
They put 30 plus or minus 2 kilometers per second, and then the instrumental velocity dispersion is 32. I mean, I don't see how you can possibly do that. So...
Okay. Noted.
Are any of these close enough where you can actually do resolved kinematics and get actual rotation curves?
I mean, they already had to integrate, I don't know how many hours, to get a velocity dispersion measurement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's an integrated, that's not individual stars.
Yeah. Individual stars at coma, these things at coma are too far away.
Yeah, the quantum coma are too far, but I was just wondering if there are any, now that people are on the hunt for them, are there any?
There should be in Virgo, and in Virgo you can do it.
So for the coma ones, we know the mass of the coma cluster. We know how many UDGs there are. I guess we could put an upper limit based just on how much mass in substructure is reasonable. Like, they can't all be 10 to 12, otherwise.
So there are not enough 10 to 12 for mass halos in coma size halo to make up the numbers. But they're enough 10 to 11. So if they even 10 to 11, so masses, then the numbers come up.
That was the original argument that was made, since you can see them down to about 300 kpc from the center. Their argument is, well, therefore, they have to be in big halos, otherwise it would be tightly stripped. And then that number that he came up with was of the order 10 to 11.
Yeah,
and
then we checked this.
This number doesn't want to be itself. So in the argument, you want to go through this?
We don't have to. I mean, that limit, I mean, no, no, that limit's actually closer to like 10 to the 9, you know, plus something, like 9.5 or something.
So when do you compute?
Yeah, right. So you see that they persist down to like some fraction of the RV or of the host, right? You know, and so if you see that they have some size, right? You know, you can assume that that size, let's say, is their tidal radius. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, so if you see them persisting down to some fraction f of the host, you know, and the tidal radius is some size. Then their, you know, then their original R200 was then that tidal radius divided by f, roughly speaking. Okay, and so that works out to Angel's number that I quoted.
But then you have to multiply up to the what you would get if you went up to the field value grades of the inform mass.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean by that.
So you already have them.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it's tricky about what exactly the definition you use for tidal radius varies.
Yes, I'm just, you know, setting the tidal radius as the radius for the density inside equals the density ambiently. And so, yeah. Exactly, yeah. It's that 0.15.
So, right, so roughly you can estimate the tidal radius now as, you know, where density is enclosed density of internal dwarf halo or subway halo is roughly equal to internal density of this radius. And you know that if they are in 10 to 11, for example, then the tidal radius would, so in other words, the tidal radius would be roughly this fraction, but now subway halo. So now you know that 10 to 11 has 100 kiloparsec tidal radius, means that tidal radius would be 15 kiloparsecs.
Well, there's a fairly large factor because of the difference in concentration between the coronal mass and
actually, it goes the opposite direction, so it actually increases. So when we did this estimate, using proper concentration and everything, you get something like 10 to 11 solar masses here, where you get 22 kiloparsecs tidal radius. So 22 is safe. They can survive just fine. It's consistent with this. And then even 10 to 10 gives you something like 7 or 8 kiloparsecs, which is still fine. So it's something a few times 10 to 9 is where you start from.
So we know that they're sort of above a few times 10 to the 9 and below 10 to the 12, that's sort of where we're at.
So something like, it looks like they're 10 to the 10 to the 11.
Right, but for the things of the same stellar mass, normal, you'd say that their halo mass was around 10 to 10. So if it's consistent with 10 to 10, then that's consistent with all the other dwarfs of the same stellar mass.
Is there a way to use that, say, the specific frequency and number of clusters?
Yeah, that's the way it's been done for at least a couple of candidates. So there's something like this, you must be able to solve this in like three or four now, there's a claim measurement of a halo mass, and a couple of them are from dynamics, and the others are just from global cluster analysis.
Right, so Aaron will talk about that next week. My reading of the papers, just like to summarize it, the numbers are kind of so.
Well, the estimates you can get. I was on a paper with Nicole Amoresco and Monachese, which claimed that there were very few global clusters which basically stacked the Lagley sample in coma using the HST images to get the mean number of global clusters associated with an object, but found very few. So we argued in the paper, which I think was put on the archive, and this showed they had low mass halos. We've since discovered there was a problem with the Hammer et al. Photometry we were using, because it hadn't properly corrected for the enhanced surface brightness of the background unit of the UDG itself. And so Nicole is now currently reanalyzing it, and the numbers will go up, so I'm not quite sure what the numbers will be.
Right. Which I think is estimate of the mass, though. Yeah,
was low.
Yeah, but low here means like kind of
the. Comparable what's expected for normal dwarfs in the same stellar mass.
Right. So kind of the 10.
Yeah. So Aaron will basically of order one globular cluster per object.
Simon, I was looking at Peter's recent globular cluster estimate paper today. And I was, since you looked at something similar for this.
You speak up because it's recorded.
Oh, okay.
Unless you don't want to.
No, that's okay. I'm not going to say anything disparaging. I just want to know, In the most recent estimate of the globular cluster counts for the two most recent dragonfly UDGs, there's the number which are actually observed, which they do this, you know, point source masking, and then they go back and. But then that number which is observed is just multiplied by the number 4. No, but it's fine.
Well, this is the completeness correct. Right? Because they don't say why.
It was not the completeness correction.
In fact,
there was a completeness correction that was applied, and then at the end, it actually says very clearly, it's not hidden, like it actually says it a couple times in the draft, that this number is multiplied by the number 4 to get from the true number, from the observed number, but it doesn't give a citation.
So I can explain.
You can explain this? Is there a reason for this?
Half of that factor I understood immediately, even though I don't think it's spelled out. Uh-huh. Half I couldn't understand, so I asked Aaron. So he replied, so you can ask him for details next week, but I can just explain why this correction. Right. So they. So first of all, they. I don't know if it's because they're running into background or because the images don't go far enough. But they're measuring number the surface density of globular clusters. So it's number per square second as a function of radius relative to effective radius of the host UDG. And they're seeing something like a surgic profile, which then kind of hits something in the background, some flux. And then they only plot it out to about 3 units. Then they actually count within 1.5. So they're seeing some profile, and they count clusters within 1.5. They correct for the background, because background contains some object that they would detect according to their criteria as well. Which I guess it was closest flat on here. Then this corrected number is multiplied by a factor of 4. So they call NGC is then 1.5 RB that they after correction, after the ground correction. They call this a NGC observed. But because it's counted within 1.5 RE, and they make an argument in the paper that the distribution of global clusters is somewhat more extended in the galaxy, therefore the effective half number radius is something like 1.5, 2 times RE. You immediately have to multiply this number by 2 because you're counting it within half number radius. I should say, from reading the result, it's half number radius is very highly uncertain by a factor of 1.5 if it's a 2. So. There's uncertainty in this number. Then they look at the luminosity function of globular clusters. This number of globulars in a given galaxy is a function of absolute magnitude. And they're seeing only half of the distribution. They're seeing it rise, but the usual distribution of these luminosities is bell-shaped, which Mike Fall explained to us is due to evaporation on small mass end. Right? So in Milky Way, it's known that in another galaxy, this function will be like this. They're only seeing this part, and I think they argue that they've seen at least out of the peak. And so they apply a factor of 2 to this function, another factor. So that's where a factor of 4 comes from. But the thing that you can ask, somebody can ask Aaron, and I did ask him, is if I understand, they don't apply, there's no error assumed in this number, and it's not propagated towards final count. The final count, as far as I can tell, just contains uncertainty of the actual Poisson count, zero count, which is 24%. But to go from that to the total number, I think the error should go up to 100%. That hasn't been done, as far as I can tell. But again, this is maybe better to be discussed with Anna next week.
So, Andre, are you going to talk a little bit about like hydro calculations and what we might expect from the, you know, so obviously they have different sort of star formation histories, or something's very different about if they're in the same halo masses, something's very different about their pasts and how they turn their gas into stars. And so we have some hope of measuring these halo masses from lensing and from maybe in Virgo from actually getting rotation curves, but do we have some hope of maybe being ahead of the observers and saying how you get these.
So let's actually talk about one quote from the nominal paper, which we should be discussing. It's Vandenberg. And I think two quotes particularly are interesting from the paper. One is distribution of effective radii of the CDGs, this is what you see here. They find that it's continuous. So again, there's no like multimodal population. And there's lots of different points here, but effectively what you should look at are either these gray diamonds or colored, green red points. And they fit parallels, but you can kind of see that it's not quite parallel because these diamonds are flat here, then they kind of do this, right? So whatever you think about it, it's not quite parallel, but it's roughly, if you want to fit a parallel, it's roughly r to minus 3. In massive clusters, they found something like this before in the previous 2016 paper. But what was shown by Mariska and Lawyer is that if you just assume that sizes are set by spins, so to set it out as a standard Hermite white model, they can fit this distribution. So it means that it's consistent with log normal. If these galaxies leave in terms of candidate and zero and so on. Right. So that's one. So this is kind of updated. So if you want a model of these galaxies, this sample is large enough to give you the size distribution. And the second thing from the second clause in this paper is this one, which is the number of autodiffuse galaxies in their definition as a function of halo mass. And here now they span quite a large range. So this is a previous measurements in several galaxy clusters.
Yes, ignore it. Sorry about this.
Fine. Laser vision, right?
I feel donkey's at the
I was impressed, I didn't have time to follow up on this point, but I was impressed that a cluster like this exists and they can measure 2,000 GPUs in it. It's a principle of 2017. I don't know if somebody knows about this. It sounds like a remarkable system. But it's consistent with the relation found in smaller masses. These are few clusters from the previous study. This is this paper that just came out. And in this paper, they did a survey of DGs using Keats survey and cross-correlated with the gamma groups. And gamma groups are friends of friends groups found within a gamma survey. And they also have calibration from stacked weak lensing of how the total luminosity of galaxies in the group correlates with halo mass, which is what they use here to convert. Essentially, PDGs look like there's this linear correlated with halo mass, which is what's expected if there's just some satellites about the halo mass. Normalization of the solution, like I said, implies something of the halo masses. This is according to estimates that we made a couple of weeks ago. Some consistent 10 to 12, but 10 to 11 is fine.
So the plot compared this with the Frank galaxy number is also interesting.
That's right. I can bring it up from the paper. So they compared it with bright force bringing up. I didn't want to bring it up because I think it's trivial in the sense that for bright galaxies, we know that the count should not be linear. Just because the central is included, right?
No, but I did a correction. I subtracted the central, and then the slope gets like 0.87, so it was still steeper. You sort of see it immediately in the plot.
I mean, the numbers were quite high, so subtracting one doesn't really make much difference.
That was my first thought as well, and then I actually did this correction, and it.
How did you do the correction?
So this
you subtract one.
So it looks
wait,
like
the
cluster is about
10.44. So you see that the second blue data point?
Well, that was it.
The second blue beta point sits at 3, so that should be 2, and that's how basically the slope changes. It's not.
So basically, if you throw away the left 3 points, the others, the correction one doesn't make much difference to
you. You get a point of 8.887.
But then these points are perfectly consistent with black points.
So what you can see is around a couple times 10 to the 13, there's a factor of 2 difference between the black and whereas on the right hand side, they basically overlap. So
that's consistent with the same if you subtract 1 from there, right?
No, well, subtract 1 from there is easy.
4 is 3, yeah.
Yeah. So it gets a bit steeper, but it's still different. It's still different.
Is that a lot?
Huh?
Wait.
Well, it's a thin error bar than I agree, doesn't it?
0.87.
Maybe if you subtract 1 here, you'll get something closer here, right?
But you don't have to look at the fit, I'm just looking at individual data points.
Look at the, look at the next data point. It's at 3. Mm-hmm. Put it down by 2.
It's 2.7.
Okay. 1.7. Right. That's the slope. You get a slope of 0.87.
This is what's in there.
Yeah, but it's consistent, systematic.
So what are the two error bars in the
frame? Okay. It's
n to the 1.11 plus or minus 0.07.
Don't worry about fit, just look at the points. Individual points.
Well, what about them?
Well, it's clear at the right that they coincide. There's no separation. If you take the points to the points around 10 to the 13, there's clearly an offset, which isn't really about 2 sigma if you put all those points together. So, okay, it's probably about 3 sigma.
What's the... What?
Because there's very little error bar in the right ones.
Blue points, there's so many things there, essentially no error bar.
But here's a... I think this really has to be for the model, full way, because if you read the paper, the way that, what they call outer phase set wise, because they select them first, they select the sample in arcseconds, so they make a cut on effective labels in arcseconds. Then, when they analyze each group, they assume that all the UDGs around that group are at that redshift, and then apply again a cut, now in physical classes. And these cuts are actually different. They're different redshifts from group to group. And then they're somehow averaging some sort of count. Of course, when you do it for bright galaxies, you don't do this, right? So, you know, now you have to have full trust in these error bars and just take some rhetoric, right, and if you want to interpret this difference. My impression was that it was not, I didn't get a very strong impression about it, it should be taken seriously.
I mean, 0.87, there's no satellite population. I mean, 0.87.
So why do you think, I mean, it's not even obvious why you should subtract the one. That's because one has stuck in one's head so strongly that it's only the satellites that have to go linear with the next. But that's an actual assumption of the model. So, you know, from physical reason, why shouldn't it be the total number of bright galaxies? And we should go linear with them. It's just an obvious thing.
It's true, I have a physical prejudice that central is different occupations to physics from satellites. It's true. I admit to that prejudice. I'm totally comfortable with that prejudice. I've just never seen a satellite. I mean, Frank, if your correction is correct, have you ever seen a satellite population that scales like 0.87?
Yes.
Which population?
Almost anyone.
For example, populations in the Sahabi fits, for example.
All the models that I've ever fitted with CLM, if I then make a plot of the H or D, the number does not go as one. Number varies, it depends on what galaxies you look at. And it can go from anywhere from 0.8 to 1.1.
On HRD analysis, so from HRD analysis, you can always get to 1. So
yeah.
But, often it gets fixed at 1.
Zahavi and Zhang all get 1 with fitting the alpha power law slope, and it's always plus or minus a few percent.
But I guess the question
we get the same result in our paper.
So suppose these numbers were different. So what are we learning exactly? So one thing that I think we should be learning if this is if it's actually linear, that the UDGs are never central, so just satellite, but they're not central, right?
For these very high
masses. I think so that's interesting. I agree that's progress on the problem. That's a nice result.
It's not that interesting because of these UDGs, we all know that they have the average stellar mass that we infer for these things is 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, and in the 10 to the 12 stellar mass halo, the central galaxy is never 10 to the 9. So it's not that surprising that they say that.
No, but that statement, I mean, this is different from the original statement that it could be failed L-star galaxies, right? So this argue that they're not failed L-star galaxies because they're never central.
How do we know they're never
central? But they're counted around existing groups,
right?
That are gamma groups. So they're identified by fine looking for bright galaxies.
Yeah.
Maybe UDG groups exist, but they wouldn't have entered into the sample because
or UDG group was a central UDG.
UDGs would never been seen, so they wouldn't have been counted to the sample.
Are the UDGs claimed in the field? If so, the field ones are presumably central galaxies.
Yeah, but this is done by cross-correlating gamma groups, which are...
No, I understand. That wouldn't be in here.
Not in this type of field. So the original question is, are they failed L-star galaxies, right, which would put them as central galaxies in this type of mass? And I interpret that there's a...
but how do we know the field ones aren't in this type of mass? I mean, that's the second argument.
Obviously, because they were counted around.
But if a failed galaxy is actually sitting at a failed UDG is sitting, how would you ever know?
But would you have X-rays?
No. Well, so there could be.
This is important because if they do exist like those, then.
But it could be central galaxies.
Then HUD models that could put.
So there wouldn't be gamma because gamma wouldn't cause that.
Gamma's not from Gamma, they found. Right, so Gamma found, used high luminous galaxies to define groups.
Yes.
And we did use pretty central galaxies in these groups.
No, because they
get a more massive.
Well, but if that's true, then, I mean, the point of this result is just that the scaling of the number of UDGs in gamma groups scales like ordinary satellites, maybe slightly steeper, so.
Sure, the point is the gamma survey used their survey galaxies to define the group, so by definition, there always has to be a bright galaxy in every gamma group.
That's true.
And so by definition, the way you define the central galaxy, it's always going to be a bright object.
No, but that's true. But for these groups, the altered diffuse galaxies still could be central, right?
How can you tell?
It wouldn't be the gas mass, right? I mean, the coolest one. I mean, since they don't form too much stars, I would expect the feedback is not very strong.
So this is not a simulation. Yeah. This is all observation data.
No, what I'm saying, right? So if these are 10^11, or maybe slightly more massive halos, and these are kind of somewhere in the field, and they are. Yeah, centrals. Then you should expect that they have a lot of other cool gas there. Like it's not being used up, and it's not being blown out, so it should be there. So they should have huge H1s, and you can maybe use this to infer what they.
Well, it does have a number of very large gas clouds with very small numbers of stars. I'm not quite sure if it fulfills the definition. These objects.
Yeah, a lot of them do fulfill the definition. In fact, there is a paper.
They actually had to work hard to identify some of the objects in the soil. Eventually they found something in the imaging that they had to look very deep.
But are there UDGs known in the field?
What are the papers claiming for UDGs in the field?
Yeah, are there any
UDGs in the field? So one is Roman. So this paper, there's several now, and I'm not sure I have a complete census of the literature, but one of them is this. So they are serving around the Abel cluster, but they go out to outside the real radius, and they find a lot of genes over outside the cluster. There's this paper.
It's interesting things. So the almost dark ones, which have a lot of H1 and massive few stars, they have large alignments or small alignments?
Yeah, what are the
they try to estimate spins, and the spins turn out to be quite large. But here, maybe this is a good, interesting plot because. What I'm saying is that the range of magnitudes here is in the UDG range. And so, for example, these are Van Dokkum and Carolina to here, UDG, these purple points. Their galaxies tend to be somewhat brighter, but not by much, there's overlap. And they have comparable sizes. So. And they also argue that because they're seeing galaxies that are blue and still start forming, when they actually fade, that they would move into magnitudes.
For those, the H1, they always have a line width, so they have a direct measurement for big things. The H1 selection is information independent, so you can directly from the typical line width, you can measure off an estimate of the mass. But for random orientations in all directions.
UDGs.
Yeah, those are the faint ones, the yellow ones in this
point. 1.5.
Yeah, it's
quite orange.
Yeah, they're quite small.
That's W50, that's not a good measure, they should use W20.
But, but also, if you look at their colors, you see that this Van Dokkum and Romantu here, they're red. But these guys are blue.
You can see the typical line widths of them around 30 kilometers a second, so it's a W50.
Yeah, and I think what they're seeing is what people usually call them very much. Maybe on some extreme edge. And here is the spin. By the way, the line is the extension of star formation rate stellar mass relation, which I was impressed with this. It's just so pronounced break. I knew there was a sign of it, but now it may trace it anyway. This is the usual star forming sequence that we know a lot, but dwarfs are living on their own sequence.
That's the molecular to H1 transition, isn't that right? We think it would be yield way. The one best one is the ones which essentially on H1 and much more.
That's correct.
Oh, yeah. Although I'm not sure it's a unique interpretation of. Then there's a mass within different VI. So it's like a too big to fail plot, I guess. And here you see the curves are colored by halo masses. There's a bunch of halo masses here. And so the typical halo masses that you can see are for their feedback to the consistent with what we talked about. So the rotation curves, so I think they got some data enough to reconstruct these rotation measurements for some of the LSEs.
Is concentration mass, are the reasonable variation, does it do anything in the right-hand panel?
Yeah, and I should say that these guys actually are not just pure in a W, I think. They are predictions of Nicol simulations, so they are affected by feedback. So coming back to Juna's question about Harry simulation. So in Harry simulation, there is some input on the nature of the thing. So first, the main one came from Nicol, but before we also saw that in the Zoskar agarics and the North Star galaxies, when you make feedback very strong, you could form a galaxy with exponential profile with way largest effective radius. So we got something like 12 kiloparsecs from the Milky Way sun scale. And it was spheroidal, the star plane spheroidal distribution, but with exponential profile. It doesn't mean that's something correct necessarily for L-star halos, but it tells you the feedback can make star distribution spheroidal while remaining in exponential profile. So maybe something similar is going on here. And in Nihao, they studied this systematically in their simulation, and they find that for these type of halo masses, they have a bunch of dwarf galaxies that have properties very similar to ultra-diffuse galaxies, both in terms of stars, so it means that they have puffed-up spheroidal distribution, but exponential profiles, and their gas distribution is extended, and a lot of them are highly gas-rich, which was observed for this sample in the state of all alpha galaxies. And again, the feedback contributes here because it probably keeps the galaxies from becoming more sufficient brightness, modifying probably the density profiles as well. And of course, in this picture, then what should happen is that when these guys appear and enter the cluster, the gas is stripped and they fade. Right? And then you end up with.
But what makes the feedback particularly strong in those halos?
Because there's no mass, right? So everything below L star. The smaller the mass, you get progressively stronger stronger wings. That's the current.
But then you should have all small halos of form extended.
Not stronger wings, but higher mass modulus factor.
They're not forming many stars.
They're not.
These aren't forming very many stars.
Well, but their potential. So it's actually competition. It's interesting. So there's competition as you go down in stellar mass. It's competition between the amount of stars you form and the potential world, and they both go down. As you trace the star mass halo mass relation, they both go down and they go through these regimes where, for some mass range, the feedback is efficient in modifying profile and then wins. And I think once you head to ultra faints, it becomes kind of iffy because you run out of stars. At some point, you run out of
super. But the majority of galaxies on the stellar mass halo mass relations don't have size as extended as those ones. Right. So you are arguing this is because of strong feedback. Uh-huh. So, but the majority of the galaxies
Well, no, he's saying it's a combination of the feedback and the potential. So in the bigger galaxies, the potential, it kind of modifies things. And in smaller galaxies, there are not enough stars to do any real damage. But in this sort of sweet spot range, you kind of have enough feedback, enough stars to generate feedback to puff things up, but not enough to really blow it apart.
But these are still tails, right?
In the so remember that if they are in small mass halos, if they are in halos for the 10 to 11, then their sizes could even be explained by expectation from the spin distribution. Who knows, so the spin has anything to do with it, but if they're in the ballpark, they're not higher than either. They just have to be higher than average, but not much further than average. Right? Now, what I'm saying is that simulations with strong feedback, when feedback continuously drives gas up and down, even in our star galaxies, we make it very strong. But definitely in dwarf galaxies, where it's not controversial, that's happening, continuous outflows that should be happening.
But I'm not sure whether
At least they're happening in this simulation. Let's not just show that you puff up the star distribution to the extent that it becomes spheroidal and the size goes up because you pump the energy in the star distribution.
Your loose point is, it can't be, that mechanism cannot be at work at the majority of 10 to 12 solar mass halos. So why did it only happen in a subset of these halos? What is special about the halo, that halo, that it happened there?
Well, for 10 to 12, I'm not even arguing that that's a mechanism. I'm just saying that we saw example of this happening.
No, I understand.
In 10 to 12.
But in that simulation that where you made that happen, probably every halo of 10 to 12 does do something similar.
Probably.
And you probably
won't say it's correct physics. I'm just saying that feedback can do things like increased size of galaxies.
Yeah, but you have to make them very special for those halos.
For those halos, no. Yeah. But for small mass halos, that's not special because in these guys, the winds, muffling factors are high and the winds are continuously driven to lower ratchets. And so you have continuous pumping, essentially.
So then for those halos, they should all have this extended Stefan distribution.
Well, there is a range, right? So you see that.
What's his argument? If that's the explanation, then why not all are like that?
Well, I mean, I don't think Andre is saying that there's zero scatter in the relation between, right?
But different feedback, different star bursting histories, right?
So for a fixed halo mass, say 10 to 11, with a range of spins and sizes, how does the feedback vary?
Right, that's the question, yeah.
So say we say that the halo mass is 10 to 11, and these have larger spins and larger sizes. What is the differential in the effect of the feedback in those versus a smaller, more typical galaxy at that halo?
For that, I don't know. I think that's a question that Michal can address. I don't know the answer. I don't think they addressed it from what I remember in the paper.
This would, given that these have a low stellar mass, this would look something. Imply that they have higher feedback, unless there's something else they want. Maybe they have less efficient forming stars. I don't know.
Not sure. We don't know the less efficient other things with the same halo mass, right? That's part of the debate.
I'm not even sure that it's necessarily. So, for galaxies of a given population, they may be just scattering their star formation histories and outflow histories, right? And then you just generate scattering size where those that have particularly violent or repeated episodes. Got high and some other ones did not, so you generate the range. But it's true that the ones, if this is a combination, and the ones that are high should, on average, have stronger feedback for some reason. I don't know if it's actually explanation, I'm just saying that it's one channel that is identified to increase sizes. But there is not, if they're in such small halos, there is not particular huge need to increase sizes. This is why, because their sizes are not different from expected. And maybe, kind of to summarize, the reason why the sizes are close to expected and why people found them surprising at first is essentially because the relation between size and stellar mass flattens, right, at small masses. That's why you then start to go in stellar mass by quite a bit, but sizes are not changing very fast. Why this happens? It seems to be happening because the size continues to scale with halo radius, but stellar mass now scales steeply with halo mass. Right? So stellar mass plummets as you go down the halo mass. But the size still continues to change slowly. Right? And you get this band, which then makes both galaxies to have profoundly to perform surprising sizes.
So this comes back to a conversation that Jen and I were having earlier today, which is if you take a big photometric survey, the things you get a brightness, a color, and a size, those are the basic things we get for every single image. And there's been lots of studies of clustering as a function of luminosity and some of the function of luminosity and color, but very few as a function of luminosity and color and surface brightness. So if you actually analyze the clustering as a function of the three parameters, then you can figure out something more about the halo occupation distribution as a function of size. And you know, they were just sitting there for a second.
I don't know that this idea came to a few people during this session. I think the outcomes that for our contribution to this debate could be studies like this.
I think, is it a fair summary to say that if these things mainly live in halos below 10 to the 11, maybe in extremes of 10 to the 11 inch, then big deal. Nothing special, they just are extreme distribution of size.
I mean, we're probing a regime that we have, apparently, because we're even discussing this. This regime is not very well explored, right?
It's not really, we've known about it for a long time. We know that we're missing them in Sloan. But they're just a tail of the large size tail of an unknown existing population. But if they really live in halos 10 to 12,
yes,
on average, then we have a serious issue. Not only because it means that all the HD models that we've constructed in the past, where we assume that the occupation for 10 to the 12 solar mass halos is one, for typical galaxies, that must be wrong because there's apparently an entire population of things that we haven't counted. That may have biased all our HD models, but also because we now need to understand why the scattering there.
Well, then it sounds like you can't even count because there's not enough 10 to the 12 solar mass halos in a coma sized thing to account for all these. So they can't all be.
That's why, but if we'll see it, that the Romanovsky stuff, the globulars are hinting that most of them are between 10 to the 11 and 10 to the 12.
Not most of them, they look at the largest galaxies. Mm-hmm. So,
well, if you look at the last figure in from Dockham's paper, where he actually plots the stellar mass halo oscillation, and you have plots these guys, they're right. Really extreme outliers.
So there I have a strong question about this to me as well.
I agree.
I think stellar masses may actually be higher by a factor of 2. Once you shift them higher by a factor of 2, they become much closer. So I think I'm not saying that this particular estimate, just as an uncertain estimate, because the color is not measured, say, for individual galaxies and examples, or an average color is a plot, right? So you have to start doing those things more carefully if you're interested how far away from the mean relation they exist. We should try to tighten up the estimates of stellar masses, and I'm pretty sure this is going to happen.
Wait, in that space, where does the estimate of stellar mass come in? I think the plot that Frank is talking about is just a plot of, like, absolute scatter plot, absolute magnitude with total globular cluster counts, isn't it?
No, there's a plot on the x-axis that plot the halo mass as inferred from the globular cluster number versus stellar mass.
Oh, but,
And then over called Peruzzi and Monster, and then their galaxies.
Look, the halo mass as inferred from the globular cluster count.
Oh, yeah. These red data points are correct, then we have an issue.
So I think, so if these are the guys, if this is DF44, mm-hmm. I the error bars here, so my attempt to fit the dynamical mass measurement gives 2 times 10 to 11 just goes through the points, essentially, through the points, essentially. So if these are those guys, which I think they are, that means that this mass is arbitrary. And stellar mass, like I said, when I estimated them, in Bellator, they were factor of 2 higher, so they would move this way. But I'm not saying that I did something correct. I'm just saying that we have to firm up those estimates.
Is this from the most recent?
But that's exactly why it would be interesting, right? Because if you could prove that they live here, this probes a scatter and this relation. Even if they're in these dwarf halos, right, we would start getting some handle on the scatter and the stellar mass halo oscillation, which we know little right now at these masses. And the scatter is currently predicted by higher simulations is not as large, which is one of the surprising things, because the feedback is very violent, it blows up wings in these galaxies, but there's some scatter, but effectively they just line up in this relation with much smaller scatter.
This is the figure above this. This is just a derived figure from the figure. Can you scroll up to just a panel straight up above this? This is the most recent Van Dockham paper? Can you just scroll up to the figure? It's right above it. No, 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 so above it, above it. Figure 4. I think figure 5 is just propagating through to stellar mass. Yeah, here we go, the bottom panel of figure 4. Right, so this is globular cluster counts versus that. I mean, these are the things that are nominally observed, right? So on the horizontal is just the absolute magnitude, and the vertical is the after the masking, you do the Cirsic fit, and then, right?
That's the issue, is whether this is globular cluster formation which has changed, or whether it's the halo mass that's changed.
Well, I'm just asking about, I just want to know about an observational issue. So the open points, I think, just come from the Harris catalog. This is from, right, from 2013. So, but the, I think it's a completely different instrument that has completely different depth. That's the red points with the error.
The red points come from HST data, right?
Yeah, but they're more distant. The issue is how far down the luminosity function of the other clusters you can get, and all the open circles are almost all near a galaxy, so you don't need such a big instrument to get a similar depth. So I guess it's really the top three points in this panel, which really long way to the left of all the circles.
Yeah.
I will say that most of the Dodo dwarf ellipticals do have, you know, some NV on the order of -15 to -17. They just have a handful of globular clusters. Now I don't know if that number was corrected in the same way that these red points were corrected, but.
I mean, I guess that's really what I'm asking about, yeah.
One thing, it's not clear whether the optical diffuse, I mean, the galaxies, at the given stellar mass, it's clear that they span a range of properties and sizes, global clusters. If you look at sizes, you know, from dwarf ellipticals, from compact ellipticals to dwarf irregular, it's large scatter, right? These guys, so it's not clear that they should always be compared to ellipticals, because at the very least, I think they should be compared to the entire range. And because they're surgic, I mean, they're spheroidal, but their surgic indices are low, right? So it's not clear exactly who they project. So if they're progenitors of dwarf radial galaxies, then they should be compared to dwarf radial galaxies, which is power neutral there, right? And let's take LMC. So where is LMC in this? LMC has stellar mass of 10^9, so it's brighter. Right? So some, I don't know it's what MV of LMC is. P-17. It has 60 clusters, little clusters. That's not extrapolated, it's actually counted. So it's somewhere here. And it has size of 2.2 kiloparsecs. Somewhere around here. So it's not as high as the galaxies, but it's, you know, but the LMC would not think anything that's.
Yeah, but actually, typical dwarf irregulars have specific frequencies as Sn of order 2 to 3. Most dwarf irregulars. In fact, that's one of the arguments that people have used against the picture that. Dwarf irregulars when they form the cluster form dwarf ellipticals, because when people look for the SN around dwarf ellipticals, they find the SN of 10 comparable to ellipticals.
And I think the problem with the LMC
So that would imply that when you quench a dwarf irregular, you suddenly have to also make a whole bunch of globular clusters, which.
So it's 3 in these units, right?
So dwarf irregulars lie around an SN of 2 or 3.
So you're saying that they're essentially in the same.
I think the problem with the count on the. On the LMC is that it doesn't have a globular cluster luminosity function with a nice scale, so a log normal shape, because it hasn't been disrupted yet. There are a lot more younger things, so probably where you're 60 or 70 is including things that wouldn't be counted for the.
But these guys are a good factor of 4 correction for these luminosity things, right? So.
But that's just to get to the bell curve.
Well, but they are older, right? So
you have to compare the counts of things which are as bright as they would have seen in these objects.
Right. Well, my sense is this set of bars should be pretty light, because this is just boson from the raw count. No, this is like separation by factor of 4. So I think it should be quite light.
I'm sure the lensing could be pushed down lower, right? So, because
And how is the least that's pushing
the How has the lensing been done so far?
The stack. Gamma.
It was kits and gamma.
Kits and gamma, because the kits field overlapped with a lot of gamma. So
and they were not, they were actually quite an extreme population of the
UG. Oh, maybe that's even, that's even possible just because they're so. The sample needs to be so close by.
But the problem is most of the UDGs that have been detected so far are things in coal mine. If you stack those, then that's really hard to do.
You want them in the field.
But it's not like the supreme can do.
The lensing with the blue field.
It can be done at targeting.
People have gone to Virgo to measure
just finding
So it's easy to find things that look low surface brightness and that size of problems that you don't know where they are. But you can find the low Z populations by cross-correlating with the low Z fields.
The low Z population you're cross-correlating with. You mean these are the neighbors of the low Z things, or these are the low Z things themselves?
Yeah, so neighbors of bright, low, redshift galaxies.
Neighbors of, okay. Yeah.
The neighbor here, I mean like very distant neighbor.
Yeah.
So you find the population, then you stack on them, and you get the other one that you miss.
This was productive. That was a good discussion.
Yeah, so you did lots of work on it, right?
Yeah. I think, I mean, for me, it definitely helped that I'd read papers before the discussion. Wouldn't be able to follow the quarter.